Thank you. Well, the way this is going to work, the meat of this presentation really is Marcella reading to you from Molly Bloom's soliloquy and some passage from Finnegan's Wake. So that's the treat you have awaiting you. My job really is to put that into context. And I'm going to start by referring to this business of making a book into an audiobook. With Joyce, it's a daunting task. And it was especially daunting for me when Nicholas first asked me, this was about 1993 or 94, would you like to abridge Ulysses? And, well, exactly. That was my first reaction too. But then my question was, well, when you say abridge, what are we talking about? And he said, well, can you get it onto two CDs? That's about 22,000 words. And I said, no. And a few days later, he said, okay, four CDs. That's 44,000 words. That's about a sixth of the book. Now, I say this because I had all sorts of reservations about doing this. That was the first one. Number one, you've got a masterpiece of English literature, and you're about to cut out five-sixths of it. You know, how morally acceptable is this? You know, I'm a composer. Do I want somebody producing a CD which is just the first 10 minutes and the last 5 minutes of my 30-minute symphony? No, I don't. But, and so that was one of my reservations. Another reservation was, well, Nicholas, I'm a musician. I'm not a writer. I'm not somebody who professionally does this kind of thing. And he said, no, but you know a lot about Joyce. You're into Joyce. You do Joyce. Okay. So, all right, I was beginning to be persuaded. And then one or two friends said to me, well, two things, really. One was, do it, it'll be a laugh. You'll be doing something you don't normally do. You'll be mixing with real actors and stuff like this. This will be exciting. And that was beginning to get me interested. And the other thing was, actually, this might be doing a great service. You know, people might actually welcome this object. Now, I was also reassured when I found out, actually I already knew this, that Joyce himself wasn't averse to chunks. He released most of his work. Certainly Finnegan's Wake was put out in sort of bleeding chunks in a journal transition so that they stood alone, and in people's minds they stood alone. Some sections were even published as books alone before the complete book was ready because it took 17 years to write. So Joyce himself wasn't averse to chunks. Anyway, this point about the accessibility turned out to be absolutely the thing, because I did abridge it. I got into the studio with Jim Norton and Marcella. Nicholas Soames is a very modest man, but he's a genius. I don't know how he found Jim Norton, and I don't know how he found Marcella, but they are absolutely the bee's knees when it comes to James Joyce, it turns out. And so this was a wonderful experience. And when it was all over, I was quite proud with the object that we produced. And here's the thing. I was amazed how many people came up to me to say, it's great. We've bought that audiobook. We've listened to it. It's fantastic. Do you know, I've had Ulysses on my shelf for 15 years, and I've never got past chapter 3. Now, I won't do the sort of honesty thing. How many people here have got Ulysses on their shelves and have never got past chapter 3? But believe me, it's a lot of people. And I'm not talking about your average Joe. I mean, my dad was an average Joe. His name was Mick, actually. And I remember him telling me when I first started reading Ulysses, I was a student at the time, and he said, oh, yeah, I had a copy of that. You did? Yeah, just after the war, I got a copy of that, yeah. Very odd. My father didn't read books like that. You know, why did you have it? Why did you have it? Well, you know, it was banned for a long time. They said there were dirty bits in it. I don't think he ever managed to find the dirty bits. And I said, you know, have you still got a copy of it? No, he got rid of it years ago, which really upset me a lot. Anyway, lots of people said this. Now, it's not surprising, because the first three chapters of Ulysses are very difficult. Well, they're quite difficult. If you've read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and you've already met Stephen Dedalus, then the first three chapters are great because they seem to be a kind of continuation of that. But if you haven't, then you're being thrown into a quite literary kind of world, and it's reasonably dry. I mean, it's great, don't get me wrong, it's wonderful. But then you get to chapter 4, where you're introduced to the main character, and suddenly the whole thing lights up with a big smile and becomes far easier. And then it goes difficult, and then it gets easier, and then it goes difficult, and it gets easier. So it's one of those books that has its really difficult moments, which repay getting into, and it has much lighter moments, which are great fun. And the book, after all, is a comedy. So this abridgment seemed to open doors for people. in the same way that something like the Joseph Losey film of Ulysses does. You know, it's not Ulysses, but it somehow opens the door to the thing. And it's important because Ulysses, you know, is very well known as a great work of literature. And it's very well known as a very difficult great work of literature. And I'll tell you another little anecdote, which is that after we'd done this in 94, it would have been 1999, the height of millennium fever, you remember all that? There was a New York poll which asked the question, I think it was New York Times, wasn't it? Asked its readers, what are the most important novels of the 20th century? And Ulysses came out top. And at the time, I thought, fantastic, so it should. But at the back of my mind, I also thought, but have all those people that voted for it really read it? I mean, really read it? The thing is, it's one of those books that everybody knows is important. And just to finish that off, number 11th in the poll was Finnegan's Wake. And I'm absolutely certain that all the people that voted for that hadn't read it. Absolutely certain. Well, now, Ulysses actually is a very straightforward book in that you can explain what goes on in it. Ulysses takes place on a single day, June the 16th, 1904, in Dublin. All Joyce's work is about Dublin. And so Ulysses delves into the streets of Dublin, and it builds the events of a day, which is not a particularly eventful day. There are lots of events in it, and cumulatively, they add up to a wonderful narrative. But it's not a book with a story that develops and concludes. And it centers around characters, very approachable characters and very sensitively drawn characters. The main character is Leopold Bloom, who's a man just approaching 40. He's Jewish, which is a very unusual thing in Dublin. He's an advertising canvasser. And his job during the day is to walk around the streets of Dublin, go to the newspaper offices, try and sell advertisements. But all sorts of other encounters happen to him on the way. He has a wife, whose name is Molly, and she is at home all day, as far as we can see. She's there in the morning when he takes her up breakfast. She's there in bed at night when he returns to her after his day. And there's another character, Stephen Dedalus, who's the person we met in Portrait of the Artist, which was the previous book, who's kind of James Joyce's alter ego in Portrait of the Artist, and so we assume is still at the beginning of Ulysses. Those three characters, and then a myriad of other characters who are real characters from the Dublin scene that Joyce knew in his youth and so on, made into slightly larger characters for the purposes of this novel. Now, as well as being the events of a day, Joyce also modeled this whole thing on Homer's Odyssey, and that's why the book is called Ulysses. Ulysses is the Roman name for Odysseus, and Leopold Bloom's roamings, leaving home and roaming around Dublin and returning, are the equivalent to Odysseus leaving home for the Trojan Wars and wending his way home by various circuitous routes, meeting Calypso and Nausicaa and all these other people, and returning finally to his wife Penelope. So in another sense, Leopold Bloom is Odysseus, and Molly is Penelope. Now it's starting to get complicated, isn't it? And it just goes on getting worse, because Joyce adds layer upon layer upon layer of interrelated meanings and sort of metaphors and so on, which all relate to these kind of principal themes, which make it sort of complicated. Plus, there's the language. And Joyce was a great writer, and his writing is influenced by great writers like Shakespeare and Dante and Lewis Carroll, who is very appropriate to this building, as I now understand, which I didn't before. But Lewis Carroll, a great influence on Joyce's writing, especially in Finnegan's Wake. And so one of his things is language, the use of language, playing with language. And in Ulysses, this begins to be difficult in some parts of the book, but also very beautiful, because it becomes more poetic than it is narrative. And Joyce as well, it has to be said, was a bit of an obsessive. When he got hold of an idea, he would play with it and play with it and push it until you got sick to death of it. Well, no, not quite death, but you know. So, for example, I think the 11th or the 12th chapter of Ulysses, which is based on the sirens, you know, these sirens whose sound will drag you against the rocks and so on. It's set in a bar, and it's all centered around music. And so Joyce stuffs into this chapter all the musical references and allusions he can. He tries to replicate octaves, he tries to replicate fugal entries, he tries to replicate open fifths, and all these sorts of things through words, which is impossible, but sort of fun. And so you can trace all these musical allusions through the chapter. Plus, he was very musical himself. He was a very fine singer. He apparently won a prize, second prize or something, in a competition in Dublin in which John McCormack was the winner, so he was pretty good. And he knew a lot of music, and Dublin was an incredibly musical city around the turn of the century. Lots of popular operas, and not so popular operas, presumably, lots of singing of musicals, songs, and all sorts of other things, and Joyce remembered them all. And when he wrote Ulysses, he fed all these musical references into the plot of Ulysses. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that sort of musical thing in a minute. I'm going to stop and let Marcella read you something. And this is from the beginning of the final chapter of Ulysses, which is Molly's soliloquy. Now, this is a famous chapter in the book. It's the longest chapter in the book by quite a long way. And on our audiobook recording of the complete Ulysses, which we produced in 2003 for the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday, which is on 22 CDs, and is far better than the abridged version, but also far more expensive, and you need a lot of time to listen to it. I think it takes 27 hours or something, the whole thing. Pretty close to 24 hours, which is good, because that's what the book takes. But this last chapter is very famous, partly because it has the dirty bits my father couldn't find, partly because it's entirely unpunctuated. There is no punctuation in it. It's just what Joyce referred to as a stream of consciousness. It's a sort of interior monologue. It's Molly in bed at night and her thoughts as she tries to get to sleep but can't, and all the things that have happened during the day and all her memories of the past, and eventually we assume she fades off to sleep at the end. Entirely unpunctuated, and therefore, when you look at the page, difficult. It's very difficult to sort out when a line of text actually needs a break or not needs a break, whether it runs on or not, whether this word goes with the bit before or the bit after, because the punctuation is not there to help you. Now, the big question, I think maybe we'll talk about this at the end if people want to, because Marcella will have a view on this for sure, is that you can read this stuff unpunctuated, but it seems to make no sense. And I don't think that's what Joyce intended. And so Marcella reads it with a lot of punctuation, which is not how it looks on the page. Now, this is something, one of the best examples I can think of where the reading that you hear is something you yourself could not provide from the page. Okay, let me just explain the situation of the opening of this soliloquy, because there's a little joke at the beginning, which is quite nice if you know. It's not important, but it's quite nice if you get it. That the Bloomsday ends with him returning to his house with Stephen Dedalus, who's got into a fight. They sit in the kitchen for a long time drinking tea. Bloom tries to persuade Stephen Dedalus to stay the night because he's an artistic young man and he thinks his wife will quite like talking to him the following morning and maybe he can give her Italian lessons, etc., etc. But Stephen says no, he's going home, and off he goes. And then Bloom, after a little bit of clearing up, crawls into bed with his wife. They sleep in a single double bed like most married couples, but they sleep head to toe. Because passion in their life disappeared a long time ago, to be precise, 11 years ago, just after their son Rudy died. They had a son who was 10 or 11 days old and died, and this is one of the big themes in the book too, that the loss of this son, which seems to be the point at which their marriage separated. But Molly is a passionate woman. Her mother was Spanish. She's a singer. She is buxom and beautiful in her 30s, in her prime, and she's had a string of men as long as your arm. And Bloom knows all about that. So when he crawls into bed, he kisses her bottom as usual, and he settles down to sleep head to toe. And that's where this chapter begins. And as he's going off, his little internal monologue just fades away with him saying, "And Sinbad the sailor and Tinbad the tailor and the rocks, eggs of Darkinbad the night sailor." And he's asleep. And she just hears the eggs bit. She just hears the eggs bit, and then her soliloquy begins.
"Yes, because he never did a thing like that before, as asked to get his breakfast in bed with a couple of eggs since the City Arms Hotel, where he used to be pretending to be laid up with a sick voice, doing his highness to make himself interesting for that old faggot Mrs. Reardon that he thought he'd a great leg of, and she never left us a farthing. All for masses for herself and her soul. Greatest miser ever was. Actually afraid to lay out fourpence for her methylated spirit, telling me all her ailments. She had too much old chat in her about politics and earthquakes and the end of the world. Let us have a bit of fun first. God help the world if all the women were her sort. Down on bathing suits and low necks, of course, nobody wanted her to wear them. I suppose she was pious because no man had looked at her twice. Oh, I hope I'll never be like her. I wonder she didn't want us to cover our faces. But she was a well-educated woman, certainly. And her gabby talk about Mr. Reardon here and Mr. Reardon there. I suppose he was glad to get shut of her. And her dog. Always smelling my fur and edging to get up under my petticoats. Especially then. Still, I like that in him. Polite to old women like that. And waiters and beggars too. He's not proud out of nothing, but not always. If ever he got anything really serious the matter with him, it's much better for them to go into hospital where everything is clean. But I suppose I'd have to drink it into him for a month, yes. And then we'd have a hospital nurse that next thing on the carpet, have him staying there till they throw him out. Or a nun, maybe, like the smutty photo he has. She's as much a nun as I'm not. Yes, because they're so weak and puling when they're sick. They want a woman to get well. If his nose bleeds, you think it was, oh, tragic. And that dying-looking one off the South Circular when he sprained his foot at the choir party at the Sugarloaf Mountain. The day I wore that dress. Miss Stack, bringing him flowers, the worst one she could find at the bottom of the basket. Anything at all to get into a man's bedroom, with her old maid's voice, trying to imagine he was dying on account of her. To never see thy face again. Though he looked more like a man, with his beard a bit grown in the bed. Father was the same. Besides, I hate bandaging and dosing. When he cut his toe with the razor, paring his corns, afraid he'd got blood poisoning. But if it was a thing I was sick, then we'd see what attention. Only, of course, the woman hides it. Not to give all the trouble. They do, yes. He came somewhere, I'm sure. By his appetite, anyway. Love, it's not. Or he'd be off his feed thinking of her. So either it was one of those night women, if it was down there he was really, and the hotel story he made up, a pack of lies to hide it, planning it. Hines kept me. Who did I meet? Yes, I met, do you remember Menton? And who else? Who? Let me see. That big babby face. I saw him, and he not long married, flirting with a young girl at Poole's Miriorama, and turned my back on him when he slinked out looking quite conscious. What harm, but he had the impudence to make up to me one time. Well done to him. Mouth almighty, and his boiled eyes. Of all the big stupos I ever met. And that's called a solicitor. Oh, only for I hate having a long wrangle in bed. Or else, if it's not, it's some little bitch or other he got in with somewhere, or picked up on the sly. If only they knew him as well as I do. Yes, because the day before yesterday he was scribbling something, a letter, when I came into the front room to show him Dignam's death in the paper, as if something told me. And he covered it up with the blotting paper, pretending to be thinking about business. So very probably that was it. To somebody who thinks she has a softie in him, because all men get a bit like that at his age. Especially getting on to 40 he is now. So as to wheedle any money she can out of him. No fool like an old fool. And then the usual kissing my bottom was to hide it. Not that I care two straws who he does it with, or knew before that way. Oh, yes. I think he made them firmer, sucking them like that. So long he made me thirsty. Titties, he calls them. I had to laugh. Yes. This one, anyhow, stiff the nipple gets for the least thing. I'll get him to keep that up, and I'll take those eggs, beaten up at Marsala, fatten them out for him. What are all those veins and things? Curious the way it's made. Two the same, in case of twins. They're supposed to represent beauty, placed up there like those statues in the museum, one of them pretending to hide it with her hand. Are they so beautiful? Of course, compared to what a man looks like, with his two bags full and his other thing hanging down out of him, or sticking up at you like a hat rack. No wonder they hide it with a cabbage leaf.
Now, that last little bit, making her nipples firmer, et cetera, wasn't a reference to Leopold. It was a reference to the other person who's been in her bed that day. At the beginning of the novel, at the beginning of Bloom's day, when we meet him in chapter 4, he takes up breakfast to his wife in bed, and he also takes up the Morning Post, which consists of a letter from their daughter, who's away from home, and also a letter from one Blazes Boylan, who is a concert impresario and a bit of a dandy, a man about town, very famous for his affairs with the women. And Boylan is putting on a concert tour in which Molly is to sing, and this postcard tells her what songs that she's going to be singing, which include La Ci Darem from Mozart's Don Giovanni, which is an aria about seduction. Joyce never misses a trick to get in something which is relevant, and that becomes a main theme during the course of the book. And also Love's Old Sweet Song, a beautiful song, which we'll play you in a moment so that you get the full guts of this. Boylan has said on this postcard that he'll be coming around at 4 o'clock that afternoon to go through the program with her. Now, Molly tells Bloom this. Oh, yes, it's from Boylan. Yeah, he's coming around at 4 o'clock to go through the program. And Bloom knows exactly what go through the program means. Now, Bloom himself is not blameless. Please don't get me wrong. He has a little silent affair with a girl on the beach at about 4 o'clock too, sort of personal pleasure he indulges in, and is also conducting an illicit affair by post with a woman called Martha. And that day he has been scribbling this letter to Martha. That's what Molly's referring to there, that she's caught him scribbling a letter to someone, presumably a lover. So he's not blameless. But Molly is having this full-blooded affair with Boylan, and some of the people that Bloom meets during the day say, oh, I hear your wife's doing another tour, yeah. Who's getting it up? And again, everybody knows exactly what's going on. Well, Boylan has been there at 4 o'clock, and they've made love 4 or 5 times, we understand, from the text that's coming up. And that's what she's referring to there. And it's left her nicely warm and tired for the evening. And so as she drifts off to sleep, things are going through her mind about her time with Boylan in bed at 4 o'clock, and also about the program which she's to sing. Now, this song, Love's Old Sweet Song, is one of the themes that runs all through the book. It's probably the song of the book. On the audiobook, incidentally, we use a lot of the music that's mentioned in the book. There are tons of songs and opera arias which are mentioned in the book, and each chapter opens with a relevant bit of music, sometimes on vintage recordings with all the full crackle going on as well, sung by people like John McCormack and so on, which give the sort of musical flavor of the text. That's one of the other things that audiobooks makes possible. And also, when you are reading this soliloquy off the page, you may not be hearing the little fragments of the song which are embedded in the text. But in the recording studio, Marcella, Jim, and I were able to deduce what these little fragments were, because presumably in Molly's head they're attached to the melody that goes with them. And that you can't get off the page unless you know it extremely well. And in the audiobook we can put those in. So this Love's Old Sweet Song was an incredibly popular song. It was published in every key and for every combination by J.J. Malloy. And, you know, it's a well-known song. Maybe you all know it. But I thought it might help you with the next reading to just hear a bit of that song as it's sung for this Naxos recording by Anna Myatt and Richard Burton.
Once in the square. Just a song at twilight, when the lights are low, and the flickering shadows softly come and go. Though the heart be weary, sad the day yet long, still to
So in this passage, which you're going to hear from towards the end of Molly's soliloquy, we see another side of Molly, which is her preoccupation with bodily functions, neatly intertwined with artistic concern, how she's going to sing Love's Old Sweet Song when it comes to the performance. And that is finally joined. Oh, there's also a passing train, which kind of turns into Love's Old Sweet Song as well. And the final strains of the song at the end of this passage accompany her very surreptitious breaking of wind.
Free from that train again, weeping tone, once in the dear dead days beyond recall. Close my eyes, breath, my lips forward, kiss, sad look, eyes open, piano. Air o'er the world, the mispig. I hate that. It's spig. Comes love's sweet song. I'll let that out full when I get in front of the footlights again. Kathleen Carney and her lot of squealers. Miss this, miss that, miss the other. Lot of sparrow farts skitting around, talking about politics they know as much about as my backside. Anything in the world to make themselves some way interesting. Irish homemade beauties. Soldier's daughter am I. Aye, and whose are you? Bootmakers and publicans. I beg your pardon, coach, I thought you were a wheelbarrow. They'd die down dead off their feet if they ever got a chance of walking down the Alameda on an officer's arm, like me on the band night. My eyes flash, my bust that they haven't. Passion? God help their poor head. I knew more about men and life when I was 15 than they'll all know at 50. They don't know how to sing a song like that. Gardner said that no man could look at my mouth and teeth smiling like that and not think of it. I was afraid he mightn't like my accent first. He's so English. All my father left me, in spite of his stamps. I've my mother's eyes and figure anyhow, he always said. They're so snotty about themselves, some of those cads. He wasn't a bit like that. He was dead gone on my lips. Let them get a husband first that's fit to be looked at, and a daughter like mine, or see if they can excite a swell with money that can pick and choose whoever he wants, like Boylan. Do it 4 or 5 times, locked in each other's arms. Or the voice, either. I could have been a prima donna, only I married him. Comes love's old. Deep down, chin back. Not too much, make it double. My lady's bower is too long for an encore. About the moated grange at twilight and vaunted rooms. Yes, I'll sing Winds That Blow from the South that he gave after the choirster's performance. And I'll change that lace on my black dress to show off my bubs. And I'll, yes, by God, I'll get that big fan mended. Make them burst with envy. Oh, my hole is itching me always when I think of him. Oh, I feel I want to. I feel some wind in me. Better go easy, not wake him. Have him at it again, slobbering. After washing every bit of myself, back, belly and sides. If we even had a bath itself, or my own room anyway. I wish he'd sleep in some bed by himself with his cold feet on me. Give us room even to let a fart god or do the least thing. Better, yes, hold him like that. A bit on my side. Piano. Quietly. Sweet. There's that train far away. Pianissimo. One more. So. Oh, that was a relief. Wherever you be, let your wind go free.
Finally, having had the beginning of the soliloquy and that marvellous passage, I think you have to have the end too. It's a very famous ending. And it's a passage which has... It has slightly biblical overtones. There are a couple of passages referring to this moment throughout the book, a couple of passages referring to this moment, which is the moment where Bloom and Molly decided to marry. They were up on Howth Head, if you know Dublin. Howth Head sort of rises up at the north end of Dublin Bay. They were up there in the heather, and that's where he proposed to Molly. So this is a beautiful little passage. And also, you'll have noticed the word yes is very important throughout this soliloquy. It starts it, yes, because he never did a thing like that before. And then every so often, about every 2 pages, 3 pages, the word yes is just dropped in. And it's a kind of structural marker that marks off the sections of her thought, sort of. And then towards the end of the book, these yeses get closer and closer and closer. And in this last passage, they kind of, I wouldn't say crescendo, because it's not that. They just stretto. They get closer and closer and closer until the yes is all that's left as she drifts off to sleep. It's a beautiful passage. Sorry to get you straight up again.
It's okay.
Oh, I love flowers. I'd love to have the whole place swimming in roses. God of heaven, there's nothing like nature. The wild mountains and the sea and the waves rushing. Then the beautiful country with the fields of oats and wheat and all kinds of things. And all the fine cattle going about. That'd do your heart good to see rivers and lakes and flowers. All sorts of shapes and smells and colours. Springing up even out of the ditches. Primroses and violets. Nature it is. As for them saying there's no God, I wouldn't give a snap of me 2 fingers for all their learning. Why don't they go and create something, I often ask them. Atheists, or whatever they call themselves. Who was the first person in the universe, before there was anybody, that made it all? Who? Ah, that they don't know. Neither do I, so there you are. They might as well try and stop the sun from rising tomorrow. The sun shines for you, he said. The day we were lying among the rhododendrons on Howth Head. The day I got him to propose to me, yes. First I gave him the bit of seed cake out of my mouth. And it was leap year like now, yes, 16 years ago. My God, after that long kiss I near lost my breath. Yes. He said I was a flower of the mountain. Yes, so we are, flowers, all a woman's body. Yes, that was the one true thing he said in his life. And the sun shines for you today. Yes, that was why I liked him, because I saw he understood or felt what a woman is, and I knew I could always get around him, and I gave him all the pleasure I could, leading him on till he asked me to say yes. And I wouldn't answer first, only looked out over the sea and the sky. I was thinking of so many things he didn't know of. Mulvey and Mr. Stanhope and Hester and the Spanish girls laughing in their shawls and their tall combs. And the auctions in the morning, the Greeks and the Jews and the Arabs and the devil knows who else from all ends of Europe and Duke Street. And the poor donkey slipping half asleep. And the big wheels of the cart of the bulls, and the old castle, thousands of years old, yes. And those handsome Moors all in white, and turbans like kings, asking you to sit down in a little bit of a shop. And Rhonda, and the night we missed the boat at Alcathiras, and that awful deep down torrent. Oh, and the sea crimson sometimes like fire, and the glorious sunsets, and the fig trees and the Alameda Gardens, yes, and Gibraltar as a girl, where I was a flower of the mountain, yes, when I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used. Or shall I wear a red, yes? And how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well, as well him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breasts all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes.
Okay, well, now all I have to do is explain Finnegan's Wake to you. Should take about 2.5 hours, okay? Is everybody sitting comfortably? Joyce went on to write Finnegan's Wake. And there are lots of connections between Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses. Like Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake is entirely centered on Dublin. And like Ulysses, it has sort of autobiographical connections. Joyce and his brother Stanislaus and other members of his family are kind of woven into the fabric of Finnegan's Wake. But it's a totally different book, in so many ways. And describing what it's about isn't nearly as easy as with Ulysses, because with Ulysses there is, if not a story, there is at least a narrative. It goes from here to here. You can understand that. Finnegan's Wake is all about circularity. It's about the way in which everything is circular. History is circular. The days, the seasons are circular. Day turns to night, turns to day. Everything is circular. And so all the themes in Finnegan's Wake seem to happen over and over again in different ways. It's also far more of a kind of rag bag of a novel, in that Ulysses is quite clearly focused and it charts a progress and was written in a 7-year period. Finnegan's Wake took 17 years to write, and some bits of Finnegan's Wake were written considerably earlier and then kind of forced into the novel. So that there are one or two sections where two bits of writing were actually forced together to make a bit of writing, which we now see as one. So it's kind of a collection of stuff. And if there's an excuse for this, well, there is an excuse for this, and this is what Joyce told us, is that it's a dream. This is dream writing. Now, the question is, whose dream is it? And this is one of the many, many, many debates that will never be resolved. You probably know, maybe you don't know, that Joyce scholarship is one of the biggest industries in the world. There are probably almost as many Joyce scholars as there are Shakespeare scholars nowadays. I think probably Shakespeare, Dante, and Joyce in that order in the world. And if you take out the rest of Europe and just leave the UK, then you can drop out Dante, so it's probably Shakespeare. You know, I mean, massive industry, and people's whole lives and careers, perhaps there are some in this room, are based on trying to solve impenetrable problems about Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses and so on. But Joyce told us that it's some kind of dream. And at one point he said that this was kind of the dream of the giant Finn McCool. So Finn McCool is an ancient mythical Irish giant. There are many stories about his exploits and so on. And he dies and falls flat on his back. And here's his head, it's Howth Head. And here are his feet, it's the Wicklow Hills. And in between there is Dublin. So Dublin has now become this mythical giant who is himself looking at the history of Dublin, and by the way, the world as well, but especially Dublin, past, present, and future. Terribly complicated. And he draws in all sorts of allusions to the First World War, to the Crimea, to all sorts of other historical events and recent Irish political events, especially the hounding out of office of Charles Stewart Parnell and all the court cases associated with that. So it's one of these absolutely detailed novels which brings in loads of themes and doesn't try to keep them separate. They're all jumbled up, and you can hit any of these things. Now, having said that, You will also read resumes of Finnegan's Wake, which tell you that it's to do with a publican, his wife, their twin boys, and their daughter, who have different names. But one name for the publican is Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker. It's a great name, isn't it? Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker. And his wife is called Anna Livia Plurabell. H.C.E., Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, A.L.P., Anna Livia Plurabell. They have two sons and a daughter called Isolde, or Isult, or Izzy. And they live in a pub, which is in Chapelizod. Is that how you pronounce it?
Chapelizod,
in Dublin. Now, if you take the letters H.C.E. and A.L.P., you can make Chapel, and their daughter is called Isolde. So, you know, this is Joyce playing games. The letters of their name are also in the place where they live. And the letters of their name crop up in the novel without any explanation and announce that these characters are what are being talked about. So you might see on the page, the famous one is Here Comes Everybody, or Haveth Childers Everywhere, H.C.E. Ah, this is about Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, the publican. But elsewhere in the book, we find that he's called Mr. Porter. His sons are called Kevin and, I can't remember, somebody help me, his daughter's called Kate, etc. So things are constantly shifting as in a dream, and it's very hard to get a grip on this and say this is what it's about. There are passages where the children, where there's a cinema, a sort of entertainment thing going on, and you get into the idea that this is an entertainment, but you're not quite sure where it's going and it drifts off. Plus all the usual allusions to music and various bits of literature and so on. So it's incredibly difficult to unpick. So, I mean, this is hard to do in a few minutes, but if you take Ulysses, you can say here is Leopold Bloom, Molly Bloom, Stephen Dedalus. These are the main characters, and here are all the other characters, and they are real characters, and they have an identity. And if you're Jim Norton or Marcella Riordan, when you meet these characters, you know how to play them. In Finnegan's Wake, you can't say at any point there is this character. And even Anna Livia Plurabell, and I think Marcella and I were talking about this before, and I think Marcella agrees with me with this, Anna Livia Plurabell is terribly important to this book. She is the wife and mother. And I'll say a bit more about that in just a second. But she doesn't really have a personality, a character that you can latch onto. You don't get to know this woman. Now, at some point, there has been a scandal. At some point in the past, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker has been involved in a big scandal, which may have involved rape. Anna Livia Plurabell has also been involved in a scandal or may have simply been covering up her husband's scandal, and she has written letters about this. And these things are referred to over and over and over again. Anyway, there is a chapter, the Anna Livia Plurabell chapter, which starts, oh, tell me all about Anna Livia. I want to hear all about Anna Livia. Well, you know Anna Livia. Yes, of course we all know Anna Livia. Wash, quit, and don't be dabbling. Tuck up your talk tapes and don't butt me. Hike when you bend, etc., etc., etc. And it starts, oh, tell me all about Anna Livia. I want to hear all about. And that makes a triangle shape. And the triangle shape is the female symbol. So here we are, the woman, or the Alp, which is a mountain, perhaps. But Anna Livia Plurabell is not a mountain. She's the River Liffey, which is the river that flows through Dublin. Now, if we come back to circularity, the River Liffey begins at a spring up in the Wicklow Hills. From this spring, it trickles down the mountain sides and becomes a stream and then a river. And it feeds the city of Dublin, and then it flows out into the sea to be taken up as rain, which falls again on the Wicklow Hills and becomes a stream and a river. So the River Liffey is circular. So Anna Livia Bell, Anna Livia Plurabell is circular. And because of that, she also represents time, because time is circular. It never ends. It repeats. So Anna Livia Plurabell, hold on to this for a while. She's water. She's rivers. She's also time. And every now and then you hear a time check. At the thud stroke, it will be 1:30 kissing time. At the thud stroke, it will be time to kiss again. Like the old talking clock. Do you remember that one? At the third stroke, it'll be 3:45 and 40 seconds. Beep, beep, beep. We don't have that anymore. But, you know, Joyce did. And the third stroke, 1:30 kissing time. So she's time. And she is the mother figure. She's Gaia Tellus. And she is somehow in her youth has been involved in some illicit things and so on. She's worth gossiping about. And the Anna Livia Plura Belle chapter is entirely a gossip about Anna by two washerwomen, one on that side of the River Liffey and one on this side of the River Liffey. And while they wash their clothes by the river, they gossip about Anna Livia. Do you hear what she said? Oh, where the old cheb went foot? And said, oh, yes, I know, wash quit and don't be dabbling. Talk up your talk, etc. From one side to the other. And at the end of this chapter, which Marcella reads, please go listen to this, because Marcella reads this fantastically on the audio tape, with these two characters switching from one to the other. Will we hear a bit of that now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end, as night falls, the two washerwomen turn back to tree and stone beside the river, because they're not real either. They are sort of mythical, timeless objects which have just come to life for this little chatter. So Marcella's now going to read the end. Now, this chapter, remember what I said about the musical chapter in Ulysses? This chapter is another good example of Joyce absolutely like a dog with a bone. Every river in the world he can think of, he squeezes into this somewhere. So, you know, people are oozing by on their Clydeway and things like that, which is two rivers in one phrase. And there are a few little references like that in here. So it's watery in the very language of the thing. Well, enough. Shall we hear this washerwomen gossip?
We'll meet again, we'll part once more. The spot I'll seek if the hour you'll find. My chart shines high where the blue milk's upset. Forgive me quick, I'm going, bye-bye. And you, pluck your watch, forget me not, your even load. So save to journey's end. My sight are swimming thicker on me by the shadows to this place. I so home slowly now, by own way, my valley way. Towy I too, rat mine. Ah, but she was a queer old scot anyway, and Olivia Trinketoes, and sure he was a queer old bunce too. Dear dirty dumpling, foost their father of Fingals and Dothergills, Gammer and Gaffer were all their gangsters. Hadn't he 7 dams to wive him? And every dam had her 7 crutches, and every crutch had its 7 hues, and each hue had a differing cry. Suds for me and supper for you, and the doctor's bill for Joe John. Before. He married his markets cheap by foul, I know, like any Etrurian Catholic heathen, in their pinky, lemony, creamy bernies, and their Turkish Indian mauves. But at milk at mass, who was the spouse? Then all that was fair. 'Tis elven land. Teams of times and happy returns, the same anew. Ordovico or Viricordo, Anna was, Livia is, Plura Belle's to be. Northmen's thing made south folks place, but how multiplurators made each on in person. Latin me that, me Trinity scholard, out of your Sanskrit into our Aryan. Hercus Chivus Eblanensis. He had buckgoat paps on him, soft ones for orphans. Oh, Lord, twins of his bosom. Lord save us, and ho. Hey? What all men? What? His tittering daughters of. Walk. Can't hear with the waters of, the chittering waters of, flittering bats, field mice, bulk talk. Ho. Are you not gone a home? What? Tom Malone? Can't hear with bulk of bats, all them lithium waters of. Ho. Talk, save us. My foose won't moose. I feel as old as yonder elm. A tale told of Sean or Shem. All Livia's daughter sons. Dark hawks hear us. Night. My whole head hauls. I feel as heavy as yonder stone. Tell me of John or Sean, who were Shem and Sean, the living sons or daughters of?
night now.
Tell me, Ellum.
Nice.
Tell me tale of stem or stone, beside the rivering waters of, hither and tithering waters of.
Nice.
You can hear from that that the language is musical in the way that it works. It's musically constructed language. I've heard lots of people say that Joyce's work is music. I don't agree with that for one moment, but it is full of music, and it is musical and has to be read musically. I didn't mention right at the beginning that the title Finnegan's Wake is the title of a 19th century American Irish ballad, The Ballad of Finnegan's Wake, which is a tale about a builder. He carries a hod, and he likes to drink. And one day, when having a very serious hangover after drinking, he climbs his hod, climbs his ladder with his hod, and he falls, and he cracks his skull, and he dies. So they take him home for the wake, and they set him up on the bed, and they have a big party. They bring in tea and cake, and a big fight breaks out. And somebody throws a bottle of whiskey at somebody else, and it misses, and it hits the wall above Tim Finnegan's head, and the whiskey trickles down, and he revives. Ach, to the devil, do you think I'm dead? It's a great song, and it's circular. It's the fall of man, as a matter of fact, and his revival. Tim Finnegan lived in Walking Street, an Irish gentleman, mighty yard. He'd a bit of a broke, so nice and sweet, and to rise in the world, he carried a hod. Now, Tim had a kind of a tippling way, to the love of liquor he was born, and to help him with his work each day, he'd a drop of the creature every morn. Whack-a-roo, dance to your partner, wet the floor, you know, it's rumbustious stuff. It's comic stuff. And he parodies, you know, this song is parodied in various parts of the book so that the rhythm of the song kind of, there's a passage that starts, one worn and filled, tippling full, his howd field heavy, his hod it did shake, there was a wall, of course, an erection. Dom, he stuttered from the latter, damn, he was dod, master matoom, master matom, when him on merries, his loot is all long, for all the world to see. Shies, McCool, why did you die of it? You know, it's all the bits of the song kind of scrambled and joy seized. And so this is a lovely book to read because you get bits and pieces of this and Dear Ken John Peel and Humpty Dumpty and all sorts of other things springing out of the page. But you have to work for it. But not if you listen to it, because we worked it out for you. So we're going to finish now with Marcella reading the final lines of Finnegan's Wake, because like Ulysses, it finishes with the soliloquy of the mother, the woman figure, in bed as dawn breaks. And remember, she's the River Liffey, and she's flowing out into the sea to be taken up to fall again. And if there's one thing that people know about Finnegan's Wake, it's that the final sentence ends mid-sentence, and that if you like, you can join it up to the beginning of the book, and it carries straight on again. So the book begins, River Run, past Even Adams, from swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs. Howth Castle and environs. Humphrey Chimpton, here we go. River Run, past Even Adams. And the book ends with, away, alone, alast, a love, along the river run past even. So it's, the whole book is kind of circular, but I don't know anybody's actually done that. Gone round for the second time, I mean, in one reading. So this is the final, I'm going to say one more tiny thing, because when Nicholas asked us to do this, he said perhaps we'd like to do something connected to the personalities of Molly Bloom and Olivia Plura Bell and their connection to Joyce's wife, Nora Barnacle. And I don't buy this thing about the sort of very personal connection completely myself. But in sort of thinking about it and looking around, I discovered that there's a fairly recent book which Stephen Joyce tried very hard to stop being published, because he tries to stop anything happening to do with Joyce's work. And he owns the copyright. But he couldn't stop it being published. And it's a book about Joyce's daughter, Lucia, who was committed to an institution in her 20s as being insane, I guess, but who was a very brilliant person and a very complex person. And I haven't read this book myself yet, but I've read about the book. And one of the things which is said in this book is that some of the language of Finnegan's Wake came from Lucia Joyce. And in one thing that is quoted is a line that we're going to hear now from Marcella. Carry me along, Taddy, like you done through the toy fair. If I seen him bearing down on me now under white spread wings like he'd come from archangels, I think I'd die down over his feet, humbly dumbly, only to wash up. Well, maybe Joyce's daughter said something along those lines. Who knows? But the idea that some of this language has also kind of percolated through this child, unbalanced, childish kind of, is quite interesting and something that we can think about. Anyway, this is the final beautiful passage from Finnegan's Wake.
I am passing out. Oh, bitter ending. I'll slip away before they're up. They'll never see, nor know, nor miss me. And it's old and old, it's sad and old, it's sad and weary. I go back to you, my cold father, my cold mad father, my cold mad fiery father, till the near sight of the mere sight of him, the moils and moils of it moan and owning, makes me sea silt salt sick, and I rush my only into your arms. I see them rising. Save me from those terrible prongs. Two more, one, two more men's more. So, Ave Lavel. My leaves have drifted from me, all. But one clings still. I'll bear it on me to remind me of. So soft. This morning hours. Yes. Carry me along, Taddy, like you done through the toy fair. If I seen him bearing down on me now under white spread wings, like he'd come from archangels, I think I'd die down over his feet, humbly dumbly, only to wash up. Yes, Tid. There's where. First, we pass through grass, but hush the bush to whoosh. A gull. Gulls. Far calls. Coming far. End here. Us then. Finn again. Take. But softly, memory, till thousands thee. The keys too, given. Away, alone, a last, a loved, a long there.